Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen, and it's October 12th, 2016. And if you've never been here before, what'll happen is I'll sort of hold forth for a bit, and then we'll open it up for questions, discussion, and really close to 8:30. And then I'll always stick around afterward if you have something personal you want to bring up. Also, these talks are being recorded and they're being posted to my website. So if you want to go back and listen to something again, or if you don't get to come sometime and you want to listen again, you're very welcome to go back and listen to that material and, of course, share it freely with anybody you want to. All right. So as you probably know, if you've been here, we've been exploring mindfulness this year, working our way through the Buddhist framework of the applications of mindfulness, the foundations or establishments of mindfulness. What are we mindful of, and why is that important? So he started with the body. That's the first foundation of mindfulness. Then he moves to the hedonic tone of experience, sometimes called the feeling tone of experience, as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. We might add other things as well, such as the sense of being in a relational field or not, as an aspect of experience. And then in the third foundation, which we've recently been exploring, we are to be aware of mind as a whole. In other words, now that we're in touch with ourselves in the body and tracking the sense of experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, then we become more aware of what do we do with that? If it's unpleasant, do we go to war with it? If it's pleasant, do we get hooked on it? If it's neutral, do we dissociate and become deluded and spaced out, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, there are a number of major themes that the Buddha draws our attention to, such as seven factors of awakening, like tranquility or concentration, or what are sometimes called hindrances, like doubt or anger or sloth and torpor, among the other hindrances. And there's some other major themes as well. So I hope today to finish up on the third foundation of mindfulness and then segue into the fourth foundation, which has sort of the major lists in Buddhism, right? The seven factors of awakening, the five hindrances, the four noble truths, the five aggregates of experience, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so today, I want to wrap up by talking about motivation, purpose, intention that colors our orientation to experience in the world moment by moment by moment. And I want to begin by reading a few passages from the Dhammapada, a collection of short and sweet teachings, sayings from the early traditions of Buddhism. And so I'll just set this up here. So this is from the chapter three, the one on the mind. Very appropriate. So starts out, the sections I'll read. For one who is awake, whose mind isn't overflowing, whose heart isn't afflicted, and who has abandoned both merit and demerit, fear does not exist. All too soon, this body will lie on the ground, cast aside, deprived of consciousness, like a useless scrap of wood. Whatever an enemy may do to an enemy, or haters one to another, far worse is the harm from one's own wrongly directed mind. Neither mother nor father nor any other relative can do one as much good as one's own well-directed mind. So we have here the notion of direction. It's a pitfall to think that direction implies a director. There can be direction. And also it's without needing to presume some internal boss inside. And also it's a pitfall to think of direction as top-down and narrow. What we're really talking about here is motivation broadly, inclination broadly. Which way are you leaning as you meet the next moment of life? Valuing broadly, purpose or aim or priority broadly, including latent values, background values, background aims that shape or condition how we meet the next moment and what we do with it. So being aware of the general quality, what's our purpose that's running? Like, for example, I watch that in an interaction with people in my life. My favorite Dharma teacher, my wife. So here we are, we're talking about something. I have no idea what it is, like how to cook broccoli properly, usually as mundane as that. And something's going on. And fairly soon, I'll try to notice, what are my intentions here? Is it the usual, prove myself right, avoid being wrong, and so forth? Or is there a different kind of intention running, like the seeking of truth, or the forming of harmony, or learning what there might be to learn here? Or, honestly, sometimes speaking from the heart in a very real and strong way, and then seeing what happens. What are the intentions, right? So being aware of our intentions, including background motivations, can be very, very useful. And I want to offer a little bit of, for me, relevant brain science about it, and then talk about four practical suggestions and see what you make of all this. Okay? So I think relevant brain science, two things. So right now, if anyone is not conscious, raise your hand. Right? Okay, you're conscious, you're awake, right? If anybody's asleep, raise your hand. No, I think everybody's awake. So basic, we know there is wakefulness. Pretty much any animal with a nervous system goes through states of wakefulness and sleepfulness. Is a squirrel having experiences? Right? I think so. Is a spider having experiences? We helped this spider get out of our house last night. I did. My wife's afraid of spiders. And so anyway, but it's good. And I could see the spider scrabbling around frantically inside this little glass jar I used to slip some cardboard underneath and carry him, her, it, whatever, outside. And I think that spider was having experiences. Just recently, I read some studies that showed that crawfish, shrimp, basically, have the neural basis for anxiety, just that we do. And they seem to act in ways that are very consistent with human, or we could say, quote unquote, higher animals like cats or monkeys or dogs, whatnot, that seem to display fear. So think about shrimp being scared of being hurt, right? Or bumblebees. Recently, I was reading a study that honeybees have the neural machinery of reward. And when they get to connect with sugar water, their dopamine systems really light up, okay? I suspect they too are having experiences. Maybe worms way down there are zombies, I don't know. But I think on the continuum, us and other creatures, on the whole, we're having experiences. There is some form of awareness, some form of experiencing. Okay. So what in our brains, your brains right now, 3 pounds of tofu-like tissue inside the coconut, what are some of the neural substrates of consciousness, of being able to have experiences? Sensations, sounds, thoughts, what's going on? One of the key neural bases of that, are connections between the cortex, kind of the outer layer, and the thalami, two thalamuses, these sensory switchboards just sitting kind of on top of the brainstem. Ancient systems arising a couple plus 100 million years ago. And if you break the circuit between the thalamus and the cortex, they're spoken of in the singular, even though there are two of them. If you break that circuit, that's how you anesthetize somebody, more or less. You're going to break that circuit. So that circuit is really important. Recently, it was thought that as sensory information flowed in, it went to the thalamus, got sorted out, and then bounced out to subcortical regions like the amygdala and hippocampus for immediate response. And then also in a slower track, moved to the cortex, more recent, more modern, more quote-unquote rational, to kind of figure out what to do. There's some truth to that, but a more recent understanding is that there are tremendous ongoing feedback processes between the cortex and the thalamus in which they're talking to each other. At all kinds of layers in the cortex and all kinds of interactivity. And the takeaway point is this. our intentions and perspectives on things are continually shaping sensory processing, gating and tilting and biasing, you know, how we perceive things, and which tiles in the mosaic of hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, and smelling we are paying attention to or ignore. So our valuing, our motives, our inclinations are really shaping how we see things and how we select out of the whole buzzing, blooming confusion, as William James described the mind of a newborn. You know, how we select out of that what we're going to zero in on. And it goes the other way as well. As we experience perceptions of various kinds, sights, sounds, tastes, touches, and smells, including as well as internal mental activity, as we experience all that, that really shapes how we think about it, how we see it. It's this ongoing, very, very dynamic process. That's what we're embedded in. And a lot of what that is about involves basically a sense of enaction. You know, the brain in many ways evolved to guide movement of various kinds. You know, pleasant, move toward. Eat it or have sex with it, you know? Unpleasant, fight it, flee it, you know, flee from it or freeze around it, you know? Movement, action of various kinds. So there's this ongoing quality of enaction or leaning into the next moment that's inherent in our consciousness. And being aware of that sense of leaning, inclination, and how it shapes what we recognize as true or what we emphasize or pay attention to is very crucial to mindfulness. And of course, to the extent that we're on autopilot, out of touch, unconscious, it's so easy to get hijacked, isn't it? If you're not really tracking that you're hungry, sleepy, getting irritable, it's a lot easier to flare, right, with your partner or somebody else. I was with a friend of mine recently, a very rational, meditative, med school professor, scientist kind of person. And he confessed that he really hates people who drive big trucks, big pickups in urban areas. He just thinks, what's wrong with you? I won't go into the merits of his prejudice, but he acknowledged that he's really got a prejudice. And he said recently, and this is a very calm guy, he just was getting worked up about it, one after another, right? So he was starting to prime himself. He was starting to incline in a certain direction. And then the next big truck rolled by, cut him off, squeezed into his lane, and he just lost it. And he started screaming at the guy, totally came unglued. He was not in, and he said, you know, it's because I wasn't in touch with this sort of rising tide of view, his opinion, how he categorized and thought about and labeled and linked to a moral critique of the planet and big trucks and global warming. And don't you know you're a jerk, you know? And you're like all those other jerks that I'm not going to vote for this year and all the rest of that, you know? Because he wasn't in touch with it, boom, he got hijacked by it. So that's one point. A second kind of neural point. And by the way, is it getting stuffy in here? A little warm, maybe a little door crack, I don't know, then we'll have a little sound, or that door we could crack open a smidgy, get a little fresh air. Yeah. I don't think there's noise coming out, but you know, do what's comfortable for you. So here's the other thing, and this thing, man oh man, like the first thing there is kind of like it's about insight and recognition, you know, recognizing what's going on. But here's the other thing, who are you becoming? Who are you growing into being? All right. So, as you may know, I have a lot of interest in what could be called, you know, taking in the good or positive neuroplasticity. How do we help ourselves grow? How do we turn beneficial states into beneficial traits? Right? What's our conversion rate of useful experiences to lasting psychological resources hardwired into our own body so that we can take them with us wherever we go. State to state to state to state is nice, but it's vulnerable to disruption. It's really easy to break that chain. But if you're learning from your states so that you're taking in the good and growing compassion inside, or grit inside, resilience inside, self-worth inside, feeling calmer, you know, around other people inside, then you take that with you wherever you go. So the question is, how do you do it? How do you help yourself become really receptive to good learning, broadly defined, emotional learning, body learning, relational learning, spiritual learning? How do you actually do that? Well, one of the key pieces of that that's relevant to purpose or motivation is that all kinds of information is flowing through the nervous system, headquartered in the brain. We're having all kinds of experiences. How does the nervous system know which ones are keepers and which ones are shrug, just let that one go? Because unless you have a really unusual brain with total recall, you're going to get overwhelmed by learning and remembering everything. So how do you do that? Well, there's a key part of the brain, the amygdala, again, two on either side, down in the subcortex, that's continually flagging things as relevant or not relevant, salient or not salient, important or not important. And it tends to be tilted toward the negative, because there you have the negativity bias. As our ancestors evolved, it was really important to track pain and threats and learn your lesson well. Never again, right? Less important to learn from pleasant experiences, because if you didn't learn from an experience of a carrot, well, you'd probably have a crack at a carrot tomorrow. Food, mating opportunity, nice experience, etc. But if you failed to learn from that experience with a stick, you were never going to get a third chance, right? So that is true about the amygdala, but more relevantly, and a modern understanding, is that actually the amygdala tracks what the person considers relevant to themselves. If they're a fearful person, if they're threat-oriented, if they're very inhibited and cautious, then what's salient to them, based on their motivations, their high priority is preventing harm, you know, steering clear of trouble, then their amygdala will flag those sorts of things for learning. You know, being internalizing those experiences, being changed by them, bit by bit, over time. On the other hand, if a person's motivations, let's say, are more opportunity-oriented, they're tracking threats, but they really value opportunities. They're oriented toward promoting the good, not just preventing the bad. Or maybe they're especially oriented toward deepening and growing relationships, positive relationships. Then their amygdala will flag what they're motivated around as a keeper. So the theory of this is called motivational salience. The idea that what we value, what we're motivated, related to, is what, of course, we want to learn from or learn with reference to. And then once the amygdala tags something as important, it essentially communicates that to a nearby part of the brain, the hippocampus, which, you know, really tags that experience. And then that particular experience over hours and days is prioritized for consolidation in long-term memory systems, you know, including body memory, emotional memory, deep emotional residues of lived experience. Okay. That means that how we're motivated in the moment affects who we become. You are what you pay attention to, or more exactly, you are what you pay attention to and take in lasting ways, right? In a sense, you are what you consolidate into your nervous system. So if our motivations, for better or worse, you know, shape how well we consolidate and internalize what we're experiencing right now, for better or worse, also how what our purposes are in this moment that are kind of running in the background of our mind affect What gets consolidated that we experienced an hour ago or a few days ago? So in effect, our motivations, what we value, our purposes, our intentions, don't just affect present moment consolidation, but retroactive consolidation. How much literally of what we experienced, as I said, a few minutes ago or hours ago or even days ago, actually becomes a part of us. And weirdly, amazingly, our attitudes, our orientations, our purposes, our intentions here and now prime us for being more or less receptive to different kinds of things hours from now or even days from now. Prospective consolidation. That all can sound a little technical, but the point is, you know, as the Buddha says, I think in the opening line in the Dhammapada, hang on a second. Yeah, mind precedes all things. That's the one. Here we go. Come on. Yes, here we go. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. And they mean by mind here very much intentionality. Okay. Also, all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows, like a never departing shadow. The Buddha did not have MRIs, EEGs, all those gizmos, and all the rest of that. You don't necessarily need any of that equipment to become enlightened, obviously. On the other hand, now, 2,500 or so years later, we have a lot more understanding of the mechanics of all this, which then can help us highlight certain kinds of practices and really understand how important they really are. All right? So, to quick recap, 2 points about the brain. One, our motivations, our intentions, our background and foreground purposes really shade what we perceive and our ongoing sensory experience in circular ways. Second key point, our purposes, our intentions, our inclinations really shape our learning in the broadest sense, our development. What do we cultivate inside ourselves? You may know the familiar story, everything depends on which wolf you feed, right? What are we growing in ourselves? And our purposes really shape who we are growing into being. Okay? So, 4 practical suggestions from all that. And there's a lot of stuff about purpose, in, affirmations, pros and cons, different things. I'm only going to offer 4 pretty simple suggestions. And then see what you make of all this. All right? Good. First suggestion, know what your purposes are. Know what they are. You know, you cannot not have intentions. Sometimes, people say, well, my intention is to have no intentions. Well, that's an intention, right? That's a motive. That's a want. That's a valuing, in terms of this broad territory here. So know what it is. For example, what's your primary purpose in life? Or what are the top 3 or 4 that you're they're always in the mix? Know what they are. One of the most useful things that I've ever read, really, was an offhanded comment of a person who was asked about their practice in this newsletter I read somewhere. And I think it was a man, and he said, well, every morning as I get out of bed, I reestablish in my heart my fundamental purpose in life, which in his case was a quite spiritual purpose. Know what it is. Know what it is. It doesn't need to be represented in words. We often overvalue words. Maybe it's more like an image or a feeling or a longing. Longing is a kind of intention. It's a kind of motivation, a wholesome longing. Maybe to be reunited with the divine all the way through and through, or whatever that might be for you, or to help all beings be truly happy, or like no child ever goes hungry. You don't need words for it. You just know how you really feel, but know what it is. Know what your highest priorities are, your highest values, your intentions. One way into that is an interesting exercise. You may have done it, where you just sort out your major priorities in life, you know, half a dozen or a dozen, represented maybe by a word or a phrase, and then step back and ask yourself, if I could have only one of those, only one, which one would it be? You only get one. Which is it? You make yourself forced choice. Then you pause, you take a breath, you take that one off the list, you look at the remaining. So you start with six, then you have five. I only get one of the five now. Which one? You know, make yourself pick it. And then, doesn't mean you're stuck with it forever, and obviously it's kind of an exercise, it's a little arbitrary. But it's quite useful to clarify what your priority stack is. Okay, so know what it is, right? Second, give over to it. I think a lot of times people orient around purpose as a goal out there that they're scratching and clawing toward, rather than feeling it as if it's already realized inside oneself and being lived by it, carried by it. People talk about being breathed. You know, you might say being lived by love or being carried by an orientation toward wholesomeness and helpfulness. You know, give over to it. Let it be real. Let it count. From time to time, check yourself. You know, do I really care about this? Caring is another aspect of motivation, of valuing, of wanting. Do I really care? And if you really care, recommit to it. You know, maybe you slip, you fall off, you know, you divert, you forget. Okay, we're busy. Reestablishing, you know, that fundamental surrender to the best in yourself. Third suggestion is to remind yourself repeatedly over the course of the day. Sometimes it's said that the most important thing to remember is to remember the most important thing. Right? So whatever works for you. I do collages, you know, I'll put them up on my wall. I still have collages in my home office, a collage that I made a number of years ago. And when I look at it, the pictures, mainly pictures in it, whoosh, reorient me. You know, it's like the North Star. What's your true north? Your, oh yeah. Or I'll have little stickies with maybe a word on them, or a few words, or a saying. Or maybe just call to mind, you know, multiple times a day. Hey, what am I really here for? What do I really value? What do I care about most in this life? It's so easy to get distracted or spun into a zillion B, C, X, Y, and Z priorities. What are your A priorities? You know, what's the most important thing that today, right? So, and to remind yourself multiple times a day in small ways, not in a shaming way or a critical way, more like an encouraging way or a realigning way. I think a little bit as purpose is like a river carrying me along. And many times a day I notice that I'm, you know, out of the river, sitting on the rocks, I don't know what, pounding rocks, making big rocks into little rocks. And I'm like, whoa, oh yeah. Back in the river. Oh yeah, lined up again, you know. Sharon Salzberg has a neat little metaphor kind of like this about meditation. She says, you know, there you are, you're meditating, you're in the meadow. It's nice, flowers, it's peaceful, butterflies. So meadow is like river, okay? And then after a while, and a train goes by. Trains go by every so often. And a lot of the time, you're in the meadow watching the train go by, this distracting thought or worry, or it's loud out there, it's maybe aggravating, but you don't hop on the train. You just watch it go by. But some of the time, you suddenly notice you've been on the train for the last 10 minutes, right? Carried along. No longer, in a sense, my metaphor, aligned with your purpose or lived by your purpose. But as soon as you realize you're on the train, back in the meadow, right? In some ways, it's a little bit like that. You realize, oh, okay, I've been off purpose. Okay, I'm going to go back into alignment with purpose again. So that's my third suggestion. And, you know, including many times a day, multiple times a day. And then the fourth suggestion is to feel like you're being purposeful in good company, that you are practicing for the sake of others, or you are joined in a community of purpose, a community of practice. People all around the world, I mean, literally as we sit here, you know, as we talk, or I talk right now, someone in the world is meditating sincerely. Someone in the world is treating a child well. Someone in the world is really mad about something and wanting to be destructive and regulating that and taking the high road instead of the low road. You know, someone in the world right now is being generous. Someone in the world is forgiving. You know, someone in the world is trying to be a better person, you know, today. We're joined with these people, and, you know, it's a larger conversation, but one of the things that I was talking about with a friend recently is when I was, you know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s. I went to college in 1969, and so we have the 60s and early 70s. I really felt like I was part of some social movement, you know, civil rights, gay rights, environmentalism, feminism, you know, the whole thing. And it's hard to feel that in many ways today. And I think people really long for that. And some, to some extent, people do feel part of that, you know, but there's that need in us. So there's a place to feel like our purposes are shared with others. Our good purposes are shared with others in a larger community of practice, known and unknown. As the Buddha says in the Loving Kindness Sutta, you know, the great and the small, omitting none, right? So to feel like you're with others, you're part of a collective that can help inspire you to practice more and stick with your practice and to not get so disheartened about it and to feel like, yeah, we're in this together. Okay? All right. So that's my offering. What do you make of it? What are your own comments about that or anything else? Please.
When you were talking about purpose earlier, yeah. You used the word wholesomeness. And it's come up another time this week for me in something else I've read.
Yeah.
And I don't, could you define what you mean by wholesomeness in the context of spirituality or meditative awareness?
Yeah. So I mean it pragmatically myself, and I think it's up to each person to find what they mean by it, of course, but I bring it down to pretty simple things. Does it promote happiness and welfare? And I mean the word happiness in a very far-reaching, kind of profound sense. It's both what's sometimes called hedonic well-being, you know, pleasure, enjoyment, connecting with others, and eudaimonic well-being of purposefulness, meaning, inspiration, aspiration, and so forth. So all of it together. So I think about what promotes happiness and welfare of myself and hopefully others as well. I would call that beneficial, wholesome, or quote-unquote good or positive. And then that which promotes suffering or harm for myself and others, I think of as unwholesome, not beneficial, bad, negative, and so forth, generally speaking. So then you decide for yourself, what is it that promotes lasting happiness, true happiness, you know? And then you work it out from there. And, you know, and sometimes I think we do things under a yellow flag condition, or even we go to a red flag, you know, for some, we in the moment maybe, we need to really fire up to, for the sake of a greater good, right? And, you know, but I think as soon as we can, we try to get back into the green zone, as it were. So that's what I mean. Yeah, yeah. I had a teacher who made this distinction that was really useful for me. She distinguished between, she called it the mind's integrity system and the being's integrity system. It's like at the mind level, we can get very righteous and right about our standards of various kinds, especially if our personality structure inclines us, as it does in my case, in that direction. But then there's a deep knowing inside, like, does it feel repugnant or does it feel good to go in one direction or another? And that's more like the being's integrity system. And sometimes people spend a lot of time in their mind's integrity system to avoid getting in touch with their being's integrity system because they're out of integrity with their being's integrity system.
That really helps because, you know, that the word wholesomeness to me had a bit of a charge on
yeah.
it. And I was trying to, so you defined it really well.
Okay, good.
The mind versus the...
Well, that's good. And that's skillful, too, to track that certain words just don't do it. And that's fine. You know, then you find different words and, you know, what works for you. But you get the underlying essence of it. Yeah. Great. Yeah, please.
You're talking about a lot of rational, sort of cognitive approaches to motivation and intention. I find for myself that when I can get derailed, it's often by things that are subconscious.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Emotions that are going on. So, what's your advice for kind of bringing those two worlds together? So
that
less reactivity. It seems like it's not mental alone.
Yeah. Well, so we're talking here about mindfulness. So there is an awareness element, right? We are aware of our motives, desires, you know. Then there's the question of what are those desires, right? And how do we know them to ourselves? And to be really clear, I appreciate you bringing it up. I find that the most important desires or motivations are nonverbal, and they're very emotional. You know, it's from the heart. And it's like lovingness, right? Or kindness, or the longing for peace, profound peace inside, you know. The longing to be well used. I mean, that's a very fundamental, I think, purpose for people as well, to feel like your capacities are really being used, that you're not a thoroughbred strapped to a plow, going up and down the same furrow every day. If you have to do that because of the nature of your life, so be it. But ideally, to really feel your fullness can be expressed, you know, in the world. Like, that's a very visceral thing, right? To be aligned with your nature. Some people's natures are kind of really quiet. Others are very alive and buoyant. That, too, is a purpose, to be true to your own nature. To let the feeling of it, the movement of it, you know, really express itself. So I appreciate what you're saying. When I'm focusing here on intentions or wants, what they are, at the core is usually nonverbal and quite sensory and emotional. Okay. Then you're also bringing up a really great point about the distinction between conscious and unconscious processes. And there is a lot of power in consciously being aware of, like I used in my example earlier, I reflect, what's really my purpose here with my wife? What's my real agenda? There's my overt agenda, then there's my covert agenda, right? What's my real agenda here? We are involved in there's a place for, you know, what we process in the kind of spotlight of awareness. But where the action really is just like you say, it's down in the weeds. You know, it's below the waterline. And so a lot of what we're doing, in my view of practice, including this aspect of learning, where I talked about the amygdala and priming it or sensitizing it to take in what we really want to take in and let the rest go, is we're trying to really shape what's happening under the waterline over time. So then those, if you will, latent or background or unconscious valuings or priorities, they're there to guide us, and they, when they get pulled up because something's happened, they're waiting for us in good ways. So that too. And then you're grappling with what do you do when you're pulled in two different directions, right? I think of the four stages of growth. You know, number one, you're being a jerk and you don't realize you're being a jerk, okay? Speaking personally, long day, stressed, kids are little, come home, house is a mess, Okay? Stage two, you don't want to be a jerk. I'm using the word jerk very loosely, okay? Right? You're acting in a way you don't want to act for whatever reason, and large or small. And you're very aware that that's there, but you can't help it. That's the hardest stage of all. And so you're conflicted, you know. Then stage three, the inclination to be that way, neurotic, problematic, addictive, driven, whatever, irritated, comes up, but you manage it. And then stage four, it doesn't come up at all. So over time, through repetition and gradually changing the body, headquartered by the brain in a better way, more and more the tendencies don't even arise. You know, and there's a Tibetan teacher who said, as you may have heard me quote, in the beginning of his life of practice, he says, looking back, nothing came. He couldn't get anything good to go, you know? He said, in the middle, nothing stayed. It wasn't stable. He was in that third stage, if you will. But in the end, nothing left. He was fully cooked, as it were, and it just stayed there. Yeah. I think of it like that, yeah. And you find people really vary. Like for some people, the words really help them. They're guided by the words, you know, and even keywords or a sentence. For other people, words get in the way. It's much better just to have a picture or a feeling, you know. I think a lot of what meditation is really about, or one kind of meditation especially, is to rest your mind upon what calls your heart into being. And then your mind more and more takes that shape. Thanks a lot. Yeah. Feather, a couple others, and we'll wrap up soon. Oop, real soon.
Yeah, just a little bit about, I'm still trying to form this question in my head, because at one point you mentioned that how things get built up in our nervous system, that things are coming in from outside, sensory input is happening, and then it is either going into short-term or long-term complexes that are being built inside. Can you say a
little
bit more about it, how that happens, and how not to let it get in at a deeper
level? Well, that's right. Well, first, if you just think about who you were the day you were born, about this long, maybe not even that long, you know? And then think about who you are today, what you know today, the things you know how to do, or think about the ways experiences have shaped you in your life. It's really natural to be shaped by our experiences. We're designed to be shaped by our experiences. It's a really natural process. Here in part, we're talking about how to help yourself be shaped well rather than badly. And we are designed because we're at the tail end of 3.5 billion years of life's evolution, you know, 600 million years of nervous system, right? And there were times in which our ancestors, humans like us, 160, 80,000 years ago, maybe there were 1,000 humans alive on the planet, maybe a couple thousand tops. Crazy, really, to think about it, you know? It's weird to realize, just imagine right here, imagine 100-yard radius from right here, as many people, mostly college students, in this circle, that's how many humans were alive on the entire planet 150,000 or so years ago. Like, wow, I mean, we lived through really hard times. So we're very shaped by all that, and therefore we're really shaped to overlearn from negative, painful experiences. So myself, maybe this is a wrap, and this can be too an intention. You know, what's your intention? What are your purposes about who you are learning into being? Right? You see what I'm getting at there? Like here, you're trying to help yourself become, including clear away what obscures your already beautiful nature, already wise, already peaceful, already loving. Fundamentally, like, how are we helping ourselves grow into being what we want to become most fully? And for me, there are two fundamental keys, you know. One is when we're in a problematic place, we're mad about something, we're driven about something, we have ill will toward other people, something. To try to disengage as soon as you can. Step out of it, step back from it, don't fight it, but witness it. And then gently help yourself disengage, stop putting gasoline on the fire, you know, so you don't reinforce those patterns as much as possible. And try not to ruminate. Try not to just loop and loop and loop. Neurons that fire together wire together. You know, every time you go around that track, you dig it a little deeper. You don't want to do that. That's a big takeaway. And learning what I've learned about the brain and all that has really made me much quicker and kinder to myself to not marinate in my crud, you know, my neurotic bullshit, you know. Like, don't marinate it. You know, that's one takeaway. Don't fight it, because then you just, if you hate it, you just feed the wolf of hate. But it's to disengage rapidly and not let it stain you, as it were. And then the second thing is really value wholesome, beneficial states of mind. Relaxing in the body, feeling loved by others, good pleasures with friends, sense of meaning and purpose in life, sense of accomplishment, you know, getting cozy if you feel cold, getting warm, you know, cuddling up with your dog, large and small. Being glad that someone you hope will win is going to win. Whatever. But maybe the Golden State Warriors. But anyway, go Kevin Durant. But anyway, you know, and when you have those moments, don't waste them on yourself. You know, take them in. Lean into it, including recognizing your own goodness, your own good heart, you know. Find gladness in your goodness, the Buddha said. And so when you have an opportunity to have those kind of green zone experiences, take them in again and again and again, because that'll build up your muscles inside. You're mixing metaphors, your shock absorber inside, the keel of your sailboat inside, so that when things are challenging, you're less likely to get knocked into the red zone. So come out of the red zone as soon as you can, grow green zone muscles, and keep going. That works for me. How about we sit for a minute just to marinate, and then we'll wrap up. Okay, great. Maybe I'll just read the last two little stanzas one more time. Whatever an enemy may do to an enemy, or haters one to another, far worse is the harm from one's own wrongly directed mind. Neither mother nor father nor any other relative can do one as much good as one's own well-directed mind. May you be carried along by the felt sense of your own best purposes. See you next week in the other room. Yeah, I think. Yeah, I'm here. Oh, no, I have a guest teacher next week because I'm teaching this thing. It's a wonderful guest teacher. I don't remember who it is, but I know it'll be good.
Stephanie Noble.
Stephanie Noble. Oh, yeah, she is really good. And it's good to have some diversity here, too. Okay, good. So I'll see you in 2 weeks. Thank you.